chapter 21, verses 1 through 5. And here we go. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them, and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall be any more pain. For the former things are passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And he said unto me, Write, for these words are true and faithful. We will be pointing out some principles here as the Lord leads. We're dealing here with a new sky and a new earth. And I believe the reason is that God has created a new race. He's created a perfect church, and he's created saved nations. And he doesn't want, he's made the heart and the life new of mankind, and so now he gives it a new environment. That's what he does with us. God always creates the heaven and then the earth. And he does that with us. Many times we wish it were not so, that God would do more for our exterior circumstances, even for the lusts that dwell in us. But God is ever one to get at the core of things. And so, rather than creating, as we wish he would, a paradise, in fact, right here is one of the central points of thinking that we must lay hold upon if we would understand the kingdom of God. The current understanding among us evangelicals is that God has saved people by grace, meaning he has forgiven them apart from any change in them, with the purpose of bringing them into an idyllic environment, an unchanged people in a changed environment. This is the last thing in the world that God would ever do, is bring an unchanged people into paradise. Our teaching, our thinking is at fault in this respect. God has no intention of bringing us into an exterior heaven. This is mythology. It's mythological teaching. Rather, what God is primarily concerned about is the change in us. And you know, the change in us takes so long that we become impatient. One of our greatest problems in attaining to the high level of throne life that is available today is patience with God and his prunings. Now, you can only bear fruit to the extent that you are willing to be pruned. As soon as you decide, this is where I get off the bus, I'm sick and tired of prisons and pains and frustrations, and I'm going to do something for God. I'm sick of this mealy-mowing around and not getting anything done. And you insist on it. God, who is ever a lover of productivity, will use you at that point. You will be the one who suffers in that you may delay your own growth, but because God uses you, you will take that as a sign that you did the right thing. Never, never rush about in a hurry trying to find peace in works. Because God is not mocked. What He wants to do in your life, He'll do now, or He'll do later. He's never frustrated. So, we do well to let God take as long as He wants to, and to meddle with us as long as He wants to. If it takes forever while the world is going to hell, that's God's problem, not ours. God hasn't called us to save the world. God has called us for one thing, to obey Him. And to obey Him implicitly, conscientiously, diligently, to wait upon Him all the day long. Not to lose our poise and a desire to be something in the kingdom, or to fit in with people, or to appeal to our reason so that we can understand what's going on. God is not interested that we understand what's going on. He said, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not unto your own understanding. To trust in the Lord is really the end of the matter, but it is so difficult. Because we have a multitude of pressures and expectations from ourselves, from others, concerning what we should be or what we should do. And to just be what God wants you to be, and to do what God wants you to do, without a fuss about it, rare is that individual. They're rare. Most people are caught up in Christendom, that is, in the religious accommodation to the seed that has been planted and the revelation that's been given. 99% of Christendom is not of the Lord. It's a human accommodation to what God has done. It's like DDT. You can't buy a package of DDT. You buy a package of DDT, if you look at the label, it'll say 1% DDT. The rest is what is called inert ingredients. In Christendom, it's 99% inert ingredients. Now, inert ingredients are necessary to the DDT. You can't walk around with pure DDT. And inert ingredients are necessary to Christendom. You just can't have the peanut without the shuck. But don't confuse the two. Accept the scaffolding for what it is. Scaffolding. And realize that the true work of God is done in a manger. It's done in a very lowly place among the dishes and the pots and the pans and the screwdriver and under your car when you're trying to fix something. And in the lowliest of places. And He can walk with kings. But it is not in a religious uproar. Oh, people cannot believe that. But it is so. And if we have the patience, let patience have its perfect work. God will bring forth our righteousness as the light and our judgment as the noonday. But it takes trust and it takes waiting. And these things that God works in the secret places of people's lives as they bear the cross and walk before God in ways that no one understands, they themselves don't even understand, but just bearing patiently with God, not being moved by people or things, this is what God is after. This is what will endure after the inert ingredients are gone. What will endure is that which has been wrought in Jesus. And the rest of it, God uses it, it serves. But never get excited. God's way is not to bring an unchanged people into a new world. It's to change people And when they're perfect, and the last person has stood before God, and his eternal destiny has been decided, the wicked have been cast into the lake of fire, and the righteous have entered into eternal life, and every destiny has been determined, then, and only then, there's a new sky and a new earth. So it is in our lives in miniature. Oh, how we wish to run to a pleasant environment. But you see, while you're running, there's angels running behind you. They just pack up your lessons in briefcases and they run. And while you're in your new environment, God in his unfathomable love may give you 6 months to get settled. And then the lessons begin in a new environment, the same lessons. God never promotes chronologically or socially. He always promotes when the lesson has been learned beyond doubt. So you can seek a new heaven and you can seek a new earth, but you will never find it, because he only brings a new heaven and a new earth to a new people. Our goal, saints, is not to go to heaven. Our goal is to go to God. Our goal is not to go to paradise, and I want to go to paradise as bad as the next man, more so than most of you, because you're not my age. But beyond that, and far beyond that, I want to be reconciled to God. I'd rather go to hell and be reconciled to God than to go to heaven and have some lingering shadow in my obedience or my adjustment to the holy. Because sooner or later, it's like a flaw in a contract. Sooner or later, it'll come out. Sooner or later, if there's something wrong, it'll come out. Better get the job done. You know, the dentist is drilling on your teeth. He says, just hold on a little bit more. I want to get the last bit of decay. And what you're thinking is, leave it. I can live with it. Well, we can jump out of the chair when God is drilling on us, but he's very slow, you know, by our standards, and he doesn't last you in hog tie. And he says, all right, you know, jump around for a while. Then when you get ready, we'll continue. Well, that may not sound like good news to you, but it actually is, because there's no other reality. You can't, you know, kids are like that, aren't they? You say to them, you can't do that because it's wrong. But they cannot see that. They only see the end, and they cannot see why there are intermediate steps, and they just wonder, why can't I have the end? And you can explain to them, but your explanation falls on deaf ears because they're not able to hear you. They just figure, well, there's some stupid old person. They're just depriving me of my joy. But there are reasons, and you know the reasons, but they don't care. They just want, why can't I have it? Why can't I have ice cream 4 times a day? Do I have to eat vegetables? Why can't I just have candy? Why can't I watch television? Why do I have to do my homework? Why do I have to get a shot? Why do I have to do this? Why can't I have the car keys when I'm 14 and a half? Why can't I do this and that and the other? Why can't I have a 12-gauge shotgun or a bazooka? Well, that's right. There's reasons, you know? And you can tell, they don't hear it. And that's the way we are. God, why do I have to go through this? Why can't I have a ministry? Why can't I do so-and-so? Why can't I have this and that and the other? And God, you know, if we're quiet down enough, he might tell us. On the other hand, he might say, trust me, whatever he says. But there are reasons. He's not trying to deny us joy any more than we're trying to deny our children joy. We would rejoice if they could handle a bazooka. But you know, it's going to be a long time coming, right? And even then. Well, anyway. All right. And so, thank God, this earth, the memories of what has been done upon it, is gone forever into oblivion. Thank God forever. I suppose by that time, they'll have space polluted also. They're already trying to commercialize space. So by that time, we'll be glad to see the sky go also, I imagine. The memory of this whole stinking trip, pardon the expression, but it's the dunghill out of which we, the jewels of God, are made. The dunghill that we live in. But God planned it that way. He didn't cause it to be that way. He just knew it would be that way. And he's just making, he says, okay, you want to do it that way? We'll do it this way, but this is what I'm going to get out of it. That's what he's done. He knew Adam and Eve would sin. He knew the agony. But out of it is going to come perfection. The devil never wins if you follow God. We don't need to worry as near as much about the devil as we do. If we will spend our attention on Jesus, the devil will take care of himself. Believe it. The reason we get into wrestling matches with the devil is because we're trying to do something apart from Jesus. We're trying to do some of those inert ingredients and make things work in an understandable way. And the devil loves those things. There's one thing he can't stand is to be ignored or mocked or made fun of or belittled in any way. He wants the church to view him as a mighty one that they're rebuking. He loves that stuff. He interprets it as worship. And when you just ignore the clamor of hell, fasten your eyes on Jesus and delight yourself in Jesus, the Lord will deliver you. He'll deliver you. You don't have to come down from heaven and wage battles. Rejoice in the Lord and sit on the throne and glory in his holy name. See what happens to you. Yeah. Don't get coaxed down into fighting those kinds of things. All right. It says there was no more sea. Now, I was raised pretty near within spitting distance of Long Island Sound. And before that, my earlier years, it was up in South Portland, Maine. Always on the water. Till we were placed here by the Lord, away from the water. Well, we're still fairly near the water. But not as near as where I was raised. From our front room of our house, you could see all the way across the bay to Long Island, which is 20 miles, and then as far to the right and left as you could see. On the left went out to the high seas. I would not care much for a world in which there was no sea. I think here that the Lord is talking about mankind. Mankind, the mass of mankind, is a sea. The Bible refers to it as a sea. The wicked are like the waves of the sea. And I think what God is saying here is there will be no more sea of people. Antichrist always plays on the sea. He will always move to get people to confuse their identity so they're one mass. That works to his ends when he can get people as a sea, when they're a mass that are moved by television, when they're moved by leaders. You can move the whole mass of people. You ever notice that's the trend of the world today, is to break down that which is singular and to make it an unrecognizable mass. Antichrist wants one world that responds electronically and financially to his patterns. And then see, when you get that, then you can get one man at the top. He can rule the whole thing. But if you've got a bunch of individualists around, you can't do that. It's because there are flies in the ointment. But if you can get everybody in a kind of a group think, and everybody watching the same television, everybody moving electronically, and get everything the same, then you can get control. And that's what he's after. God does just the opposite. Just the opposite. He won't work with him. He won't even work with two people. One. Just one. I think, and I may prove to be wrong in this, but I don't think so, but you can weigh it for the future. I think one of the greatest threats to godliness in the churches is the togetherness movement. I don't know what else to call it. But it's the tension of people to find more solace in a church than they find in God. And I'm not sure whether that's been true for 2,000 years. You know, we're always caught up in our own time, or whether it's a phenomenon of our own time or not. I don't know. But it is deadly to the spiritual life. It is so easy to find your solace in the church. And God, this is going to be Laodicea, I tell you, just as sure as God made apples. Where you have a church that is preaching true gospel preaching, and where the people all love each other and are moving together like that and doing things for God, you have the formula for Laodicea. Doesn't that hit you strange? Doesn't that sound crazy? I said last week, you cannot build the kingdom of God by working together in love and harmony. Now that sounds crazy. That sounds crazy, doesn't it? But I'm not up here to play around with novelties or foolishness. There's a reason for that. It's because God doesn't work that way. And for those of you who are experienced in the Lord, I think you will agree with me that when God really gets down to move on you, he tends to separate you from people. He tends to bring you into misunderstanding, sometimes with people that you've fellowshipped with for years. Instead of bringing you into a harmony, he brings you into a place where they reject you and you can't get along with them, and it's just a mess. See, he said, I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword. Yes. And until God wounds, he cannot heal. There's no relationship that will last in God until it first has died. I don't care what your husband, your wife, or what it is. And I'm not talking about mortal relationships now. Mortal relationships are not subject to this. They're not subject to it at all. We get married and that's our license to fight then. That's our license to fight. But sometimes people fight like tigers for 10 years and then they'll stick it out for the next 40, which is what they ought to do. That shows they're people of character. So there's nothing wrong with fighting. That's just human nature. That's because you've got two strong-willed individuals trying to live together. So the problem is, to fight's all right, just make sure you don't let it go deep. Just make it up at the end of the day and talk it out, get over it, and start again the next day. No harm. But when you're talking about eternal relationships, every one of them must die until you are raised before the throne of God, and then God restores it. Then it's eternal. There's no other way. And so the kingdom of God is not the product of people working in peace and harmony. People working in peace and harmony is the product of the kingdom. Now I say, well, it doesn't matter which way it works. Oh yes, it do. Because when you get people working together, it can last just so long, and then something goes bananas. Did you ever notice that? I'll tell you when it goes bananas is when God gets ready to move. That's when it goes. Because the actions of God tend to individualize. See, that's what it means there's no more sea, I truly believe. God has in each human being a tremendous uniqueness. A tremendous uniqueness. There's uniquenesses in us that even our husband and wife do not know. Those who are closest to us do not know them. That's why God calls us by a new name, is because He sees something in us that no one can see, no one else can see. He sees something that is a unique expression of God, totally unique. Totally. The snowflakes are all different in spite of the billions of them. Our thumbprints and fingerprints and toe prints are all different. God works with total uniqueness. Now, if any man be in Messiah, there is a new creation. It's something that has never existed before. It's not Messiah and it's not the individual. It's that individual becoming an expression of God, which is totally unique. Totally unique. That's why He gives it a new name. Now, none of us know what that is. We do not know what that is. So, we go along in a group until God is ready to bring out more of that uniqueness or to relate us to Him in a different way. And when He does, we may or we may not remain with our group. Our group may not foster that particular thing. It may or it may be an impediment to it. It may be something that other people are not ready for. And then God throws into our life change and uproar, and we say, what's going on? Am I backslidden? What's going wrong? Or we begin to blame other people. What are they doing wrong? That's an easy temptation to fall into, to watch that. Be very careful. And remember that when God is introducing change into your life, it is not other people's, quote, fault. People are not out to do wrong or to hurt anyone. Most people do not get up in the morning and say, wow, who am I going to hurt today? I'm going to hurt around. We don't do that. When we hurt people, many times, it's most of the time, I think I'm true in saying, would you agree with me that most of the time we hurt people, it is unintentional? We very seldom set out to hurt somebody. And when we do, I mean, God brings us up short fast. He will not abide that in His kingdom. He will not tolerate our going about with a spirit of revenge. That to God is a tremendous. He'll overlook some things, but He will never overlook a spirit of vindictiveness or revenge or bitterness. God will not overlook that. That is totally antithetical to the kingdom. But many times we hurt people. Have you ever hurt anybody? But did you mean to? No, you didn't mean to hurt them. It was because it was your fault in a sense, but not in another sense, in that it was not deliberate. You wouldn't have hurt them if you were wiser or more understanding or more tactful or more sensitive or more experienced. You wouldn't have done it. But you can't be what you're not. So what you are, and you learn. You know, as people holler out, you learn, don't do that again. Okay. So that's the way we all have to grow together like that. But what happens is when God begins to move on you, and or if Satan begins to look for your weaknesses, this is what Satan will do. He will constantly harp in your mind about the shortcomings of other people. Look what they've done. Pretty soon, they're the sole topic of your conversation. They've done it, and they've done it. And the other person is oblivious. They're oblivious. They just don't realize. And if they did, there's not that much they can do about it. Look, I'll tell you how to handle that kind of thing, because it only causes death. Look to Jesus. Don't look to people. They're the tools that God uses. Look to Jesus. Satan himself cannot do anything without God's permission. God alone can fix what is troubling you. No one else. No one else. God alone. Get in the habit when you're hurting, especially if it's caused by people, of looking to God. Many things you can't even touch. You can't go to people. It's just not in the nature of things. You just cannot do it. It'll cause more problems. I have learned in administration. I learned it in the public schools. I learned other places where I've been responsible. Go to God. There's things you can do and things you can't do. Just go to God. Just go to God. Don't touch it. Don't talk about it. Just go to God and see what He'll do. And you may find that God is doing something with you. It wasn't them at all. It was God developing your uniqueness and allowing Satan to beleaguer you. Remember when Satan was after Paul and Paul went to the Lord, remove it, and finally the Lord spoke and said, hang loose, buddy. I'm using this for my own glory. See? Now, if he'd have spent all his time resisting the devil or rebuking the devil, he gets nowhere. You don't get anywhere till you go to God. And then God will either deliver you if deliverance is called for, or move you if moving is called for, or change somebody else if that's called for, or whatever, but it has to be wrought in God. That's one of the greatest lessons you'll ever learn in the Christian life. One of the greatest dangers of an immature Christian is to become a root of bitterness. That is so easy. So easy, because Satan is constantly trying to cause that. And so, unless you're very skillful in spiritual living and warfare, you'll fall into it. The way to not fall into it is to make a practice of always forgiving people. Always forgive them. Always forgive them. And that's hard, isn't it? Isn't that hard? But that is one of the big marks of maturity. Because you see, all of us get hurt by people. All of us get hurt by people. And the individual who, instead of lashing back or falling into Satan's trap, who goes to God, learns to go to God, let God take it, and God will supernaturally give you love and peace, you'll mature quickly. But this is hard. It's hard. I'm not here to tell you it's easy. It is difficult. But there is power in Jesus and grace in Jesus, in His body and blood, because of His tremendous forgiving nature. See, Father, forgive them. They know not. That tremendous divine forgiveness that God will come into you and enable you to forgive people that you cannot possibly forgive in your own strength. That's why talking about people working together in love sounds good. It's the cry of the humanist. It sounds great, but the problem is our love is not sturdy enough. It comes from the human being, and it has human limitations. We can talk about love, but then as soon as we get really stabbed, we cannot overcome it. That's why I don't talk that much about love. I don't talk that. That's the cry of the humanism. It's in the church. Love, love, love. Well, of course we believe in love. The Bible says that by this shall all men know that you're my disciples. But love is not something that you do. It's something that comes from above. And so what I preach is look to Jesus, because if you serve Jesus and do Jesus' will, He gives you love. And that love will stand under the knifing. But the human love that we talk about, and this love, that love, it will not stand. Man, I was in a position once, some years ago, where the people talk constantly about love. I would rather live in a den of lions than with those people. They talked about it. They were the most deceitful, malicious people I have ever encountered. I've never met anything like that. But all they talked about was love. But what they practiced was murderous unless you subscribe to their humanistic doctrines. Boy, they cut your throat, I'm telling you. They were something while they were talking about love. And it kind of disillusioned me and disenchanted me on humanistic love. I tell you, who needs it? No, I'll tell you this. If we walk with the man, he gives us a love that will overcome the stabbings of people. And that human love will not do. So I don't preach love. I preach Jesus. I don't preach faith. I preach Jesus. I don't preach togetherness. I preach Jesus. Jesus. It's all in Him. And it's very easy to get all people together, happy doing things together, and have Jesus on the outside. And so there's no more see. What God is looking for are people that are as unique, totally unique. And if we are moving in the Lord, that uniqueness is constantly being enhanced. Now, it's constant, it's very slow. We can't see what we are becoming. In fact, it's not even known to us what we are becoming. And that's why God's ways are so inscrutable to us. Because we picture ourselves as a certain kind of creature, and we're wondering, why doesn't our life go according to those directions? And God sees us, let me make it an extreme. You may see yourself as a mouse, and God may see you as a mighty man of war. And God keeps leading you into war, and you think, what in the world is happening to me? I'm the biggest coward on the face of the earth, and all I, you know. But you don't know it, but God sees in you a warrior spirit. On the other hand, you might see yourself as a tremendous potentate, and God might see you as a very mediocre type of person, you know, a person who will be very, and no one really is mediocre, I shouldn't say that, but a person who is not that visible or placed in a high governmental position, but a person who articulates. Now, you see, we would say a person, a potentate, is some great one. But God, I don't wish to convey that. It's like the human body. You say, well, what's important is my baby blue eyes. But that's true until some small organ in your body ceases to function properly. And then everything goes haywire, and you spend the next 20 years with a physician trying to find out what it is. And then your baby blue eye, you trade one of them probably, if you could find out what is that minuscule hormone or something else that's got 1/1,000,000% less calcium or something else that it's supposed to have, and the doctors can't pinpoint it, and the dietitians say, you know, go on a grapefruit diet, and the doctors want to cut out your gizzard, and everybody's practicing on you. And so what good are your baby blue eyes? Because some minuscule little thing. So I don't mean to wish to convey the fact that there's greatness and less in the sight of God. In one sense there is, but in another sense there's not. Because if you don't have the thing, what good is, you know, all your brains and everything else if your flipper flobber is flobbering when it's supposed to flipper? I mean, all your brains and your strength and your beauty and everything are all spent trying to make your flobber flipper the way it's supposed to. Well, you say, brother, if you want, or sister, whatever it is, that's the way it works. Isn't that so? Yeah? Isn't that so? Well, I think you probably found that to be true. But most of us are very humble when we find ourselves waiting outside the doctor's office. That's no place for pride, I'll tell you. A lot of anxiety and humility at that point. Some prayer. Well, there's no more see. There'll be no more where you can look out and say, them. I'm tempted to say him or her, which brings us to another issue, and that is the issue of gender. And I went over that with the bees, and we hassle that one around, and I won't dwell on that because I don't have definitive scripture. I do and I don't. It's very difficult for me to picture the new world in which there's no gender. Now, I realize there'll be no male or female biologically as we understand it. I understand that. Obviously, God is making us life-giving spirits. But I've read a lot of visions that people have had in my day of paradise, in the New Jerusalem, and I have never once read where any of those people referred to it. It was always men or women or boys or girls. It was never it. Now, whether that's because God will only speak in terms that we can understand or what, but it's hard for me to picture a new heaven and a new earth with it. Now, I realize the Lord said that we shall be as angels. And, of course, he was answering a very deceitful question, a question meant to trick him. But I say to myself, says I, if God wanted us to be angels, why didn't he create us angels? The one thing that God has created us is off balance. The angels are balanced. We're not. We're off balance. Every one of us is only half a person. That's the truth. Because he didn't make man male. And he didn't make man female. He made him male and female. So you cannot have man unless you have male and female. What you have is angels. So I says to myself, why didn't God make us angels in the first place? Why waste this time teaching us relationships, union? I don't understand it. The things that are said about man are never said about angels. Never. I know there'll be no biological marriage. I know that there will be no male and female in the sense that we understand that. I recognize that thoroughly. But I wonder sometimes if there won't be gender on some higher level. Certainly, the Lord said to us plainly, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. Is that right? But what are we reading about? The marriage of the Lamb. Think about it. It's hard for me to picture its. But maybe there are its we're dealing with. But in any case, if there are its, they are highly... You're not buying that, are you, Joanna? She doesn't like that. You'd rather have boys and girls than its? Yeah. Most of us would. And why is that? It's kind of like the sea, isn't it? If you ever were raised in the sea, it's kind of like you have foghorns and little sea creatures rising up and down in you all the rest of your life, because you never forget those early impressions. And I guess it's that way with male and female. Maybe we can't conceive of a world in which there is people who are neuter. I don't know. It's hard for me to picture God as a lady. That's my male chauvinism. Huh? Is that my stereotype? God's really a lady? Or Jesus? A female Jesus? Huh? Our mother who art in heaven doesn't wash, does it? So there's got to be something in gender that goes past sex. Seems to me. I'm not preaching, I don't have that much about it, but we're talking now about what we're envisioning, this new heaven and the new earth. And I don't know. All I know is one thing. There'll be no more sea. There will be a total uniqueness. There'll never be them, those people. It'll be either him or her or it, as the case may be. An individual, a totally unique being. Always becoming ever more unique. Always becoming more in the image of God. I believe that God's going to live forever, do you?
Yeah.
And I believe that we're going to be made more like him forever. Mm-hmm. And maybe God is growing too. I believe that the universe is going to be expanding forever, which raises us another question. Where are the new people coming from? I don't know. Again, it's very hard for me to picture a finite number of people. I mean, when we come to Revelation 21, that's the number of people that there'll be forever. you realize after a few billion years you'll know everybody? I mean, you will know everybody. A thousand times over, you'll know everybody. I can't explain it to you, except I know what my heart cries out for. And I know what is heaven to me. And a heaven without children is something like a full-care medical facility for people 80 and 90 years old. I mean, how long can you collect stones and stamps? No challenge, no life, no schools, no one to teach. This is heaven. Lord, give us a few more years on the earth with all of its pains. That's the way we're made. Somewhere there's got to be something. What cries out in you? What kind of a world do you want? Gold? Diamonds? Emeralds? Not me. I don't care for them now, and I'm sure not going to care for them then. I'll take a meadow any day. You can have all your golden streets. I'll take a meadow any day. I'd rather have a cow and two chickens. And a nice little house in a meadow with a white picket fence and some flowers than all the golden cities you can build. There's something in here. Maybe some music to listen to, and no children, no animals, no nothing. Harps and psalms forever. Would you like it? Say, Lord, let me live a while yet. I'm not ready for that. I'm getting tired, but I'm not that tired. Another 20 years, I'll be ready for the day is dying in the West retirement home. Full care medical facility. Huh? The bedpan brigade. You know what life is to me? It is people. It is relationships. Relationships with God. And relationships with people. People growing, learning, coming into the image of God, making their mistakes, recovering, repenting. Sometimes, you know, you watch somebody for years and, boy, they make the right move. And you realize, wow, what God has done in them in the last 3 years. How wonderful is His workings. Rob Wish, when he was so tormented with the death of his wife, God gave him a vision. He didn't see gold and silver. He didn't see rubies, topaz, chrysoprases to assuage his feelings. You know what he saw in his vision? His wife! Because all that matters is relationships. And she was in a meadow. That's what he wanted to see. When you die, what do you want to see? Gold and silver? This Revelation 21 and 22 is a lot more down to earth. It's all couched in symbolic language, so they'll be hidden from the idly curious. But God is revealing today what it's about. No more sea. That'd be something if it was all earth and no water. You'd be forever wandering over the earth, hoping someday you'd come to some water. Especially if you were raised in the ocean. You walk away and say, when do I come to the water? No. God isn't going to do that, Dan. No way. But He is going to do away with the sea of mankind, the undifferentiated mass that Antichrist works with. Uniqueness. And you are unique. You are a unique expression of God. And God will deal with you and file on you and hammer on you and crack you till he gets out of you what he wants. If you don't fail in the process. And I, John, saw the holy city. This city is never seen prior to this. It comes down as a bride prepared. And the reason is, it's never been available before. It's not available here. When Jesus came the first time and died on the cross, there was no holy city. It didn't exist. When he comes again, hopefully shortly, there still is no holy city. It doesn't exist. You have to wait to the end of the 1,000-year period before it's available, before it's prepared, before it's finished. And Jesus said, I'll walk the first day and the second day, referring to the 2,000 years of the church age. And the third day, I will be perfected. You find that also in Hosea. He's quoting from Hosea. After 2 days, will he revive us? That's Hosea chapter 6, around verse 3. After 2 days, the 2,000 years of the church age, after 2 days, will he revive us? And the reviving is here. The days of restoration are here. After 2 days, he will revive us. And the third day, we shall live in his sight. At this point, when Jesus comes, he's going to raise the potentates of his kingdom. The kings and the priests, those who are crowned, will come out of the ground in their bodies, shining like 10,000 suns, crowned with glory. That's what's going to happen here when Jesus comes. This is the royal priests of God. The kings are going to come forth. And through them, the light of God will shine on the earth and in the heavenlies, and the completion of Messiah shall occur. Now, the earth is not ready to see that. They'll have all they can do to manage God's kings coming out of the earth, let alone a holy city coming down from heaven. But at this time now, those who are saved are saved. And they look, and from the sky, just as Jesus has always come and God has always spoken, out from the sky above us shall come this tremendous vision. Is it a city? I am convinced that it is a city. I am convinced that it is a real city. But in the description, what God is telling us here is of far more importance. Let me show you what I mean. We're about through here, so don't give up. There have been great cities all throughout history. Babylon was a great city. It had its famous hanging gardens. Great gate. What is it? The Ishtar Gate. Oh, it was one of the great things to come and see in the ancient world. Ancient Egypt had great cities. The Egyptians loved everything big, made men look like mice around these giant statues and pillars and sphinxes and pyramids. There have been great things. There's nothing here other than that, don't you see? But when someone might call Los Angeles a great city. Surely people of the days of the pyramids would look at that and the highways and the cars and the things, and they would say, this is a great city. But would you see, if you came to Babylon and saw the hanging gardens, it would be interesting, wouldn't it? But why would a man not give his life for that? If what we're looking at here is a city, if that's all it is, and it's characterized by the fact that it's more wealthy in mineral wealth than any other city, Why is it not worth all this attention? Huh? Well, now let's say we're talking about a city here that is really, the wall is really of this clear crystal here. Jasper, which is a clear, semi-precious stone, a clear crystal with pearl gates. Why would you could look at this and say, nah, I'd like to see it. What is it about this that makes it immeasurably valuable? God and the perfected people, that's what gives it its value. Not that it has mineral wealth. It, the only thing valuable in any city is the people. Because once you have gone and seen the Hanging Gardens or the Wild Animal Park or whatever, once you have seen it, your mind is on other things. You may go back in 3 months, and every 3 months, probably not more than that, unless you're kind of fanatic along that line. But after you have seen it, your mind is on other things. It is not, you wouldn't die to go to see the Wild Animal Park, would you? Would you die? Would you really make the whole center of your life if all those animals were gold? It'd be even less interesting than it is. Who'd want to see a gold bird, you know? They're interesting because they're alive. We wouldn't, you know, it would be a curio to go see all those animals in gold or precious stones. And if the gate of the thing, instead of being a model of an African village or whatever it is, was all gold and silver, it'd be a wonderful thing to see once or twice. The only thing that means anything is God and people. If you have God and people, and if you had the presence of God and Jesus and the saints and your loved ones, and you had it in the jungle, and all you had was banana trees and vines, and God was there, and Christ was there, and your loved one was there, you would want to be no place else but there. Suppose you had God, Christ, and the saints in the jungle, and your loved ones, and over here you had all a golden city. Which of the two would you choose? Well, of course you would choose the jungle, because the only thing that makes anything is people. But you see, we can't understand that because our values are distorted. And we don't understand. It takes us sometimes a lifetime. You hear people are dying many times, and they'll say, oh, you know what they're filled with. Why didn't I treat my wife better? Why, you know, some child dies or some person dies. What's the first thing you think of? Why didn't I say a kind word? Why did I have to insist on having my way? Why was I so mean? Because that's all that means anything to us, is relationships. But Satan deludes our eyes. And so we think, if I just had money, or if I had a new divan, if I had a Lincoln Continental, or if I had $1,000, if I had this, I'd be happy. You'll never be happy with those things. Never! Only in relationships is there happiness. But we don't realize it until there's a funeral. And then everybody sits there, and then values come into perspective. I mean, they come into perspective. And everybody thinks about the person up there in the box. Here's the casket. And of course, the immediate family, they can picture the person's whole life. And all the little things. You don't even think of the rotten things they did. All you think is of the good and the cute and the blessed little thing. Everything else goes. And if I could have them back for one more day, just one more day, to tell them that I loved them, to tell them how much they meant, to thank them, that they were them, not that they were something different, but that they were just what they were. Is that true? Can you measure it with money? Is God going to spend the last two chapters of the Bible talking about water and gold and jasper and chrysoprasus and jacinth and onyx when they don't mean that? No. Yes, there's a city, but it's a double meaning here. And the primary meaning is the inhabitants. Shall we stand?